Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Kevin Williamson of National Review Online today, filling in for Jim Garrity. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Kevin, interesting series of events here for President Obama after he aggressively rolled off, some would say, including me, in a very whiny fashion earlier in the week, his push for tax increases on the rich, time for them to pay their fair share. Well, since then, facts and other opinions have not really gone in his direction. Now, Jim and I talked yesterday about how the IRS pointed out that it turns out the rich actually do pay a whole lot more in taxes than anyone else. Now, oddly enough, the man who previously passed the largest tax increase in American history says now is not the time to hike taxes, and that would be former President Bill Clinton. And before we think Bill Clinton got the conservative religion here, he doesn't want to actually cut spending either. He wants to give a lot of money still to green technologies, despite all the controversies and scandals we've seen lately. But still, he does not think tax increases are a good idea in what he calls a dead flat economy. So even the one Democratic president who presided over a good economy, whether he's responsible for that is a matter of debate, but that can't help Obama here.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear Clinton talking up the green economy stuff. I mean, he's way past having to kiss up to Al Gore. I mean, that was years and years ago. Does need to do that. You know, Maureen Dowd, of all people, asked this morning, why does it seem like Clinton has a better grasp of the politics than the president does? To which James Poulos gave the obvious answer, well, because he does. I resist Clinton nostalgia. You know, the late 90s were a good time for a lot of reasons. You know, the economy was booming. I was still young. It was a good time. But I resist Clinton nostalgia. But Clinton, I mean, it's certainly compared to Barack Obama, is much more reasonable on this stuff. You know, give it to them. Between Clinton and Newt Gingrich, they balanced the budget. You know, there were some higher taxes, but they weren't the sort of class warfare taxes Obama's contemplating right now. Look, I think there are even a lot of Republicans and a lot of conservatives, myself on the conservative side, who would not resist tax cuts categorically if they were part of a real credible budget balancing deal. I know that's heterodox. I know I'm speaking heresy there, but I think in the real world, some people could accept that. But it would have to look like something like, you know, this the general approach that people like Rivlin and Paul Ryan and the Simpson-Bowles Commission and lots of other people on both sides have talked about, which is lowering rates while getting rid of exclusions and, you know, loopholes and special favors in the tax code and all that. You could do that as a tax cut. You could do it as a tax increase, but it would be simplifying and improving the tax code. And I think lots and lots of people at the end of the day could support something like that. But Obama's coming out there with this stuff, you know, this bright line at $250,000 and making it all very much, you know, divide and conquer, class warfare sort of stuff. And I think that's it's bad politics for a lot of reasons, because it's not like his base is going to go vote for somebody else. They're just not. They're going to vote for him. They're stuck with him. They're not going to vote for a Republican. It's a cultural thing. They just couldn't pull the lever. They'd feel dirty and bad about themselves if they did. He could be out there getting a much better deal that not only would get him probably some more revenue, which is what he wants, but also would put the country on track toward having a more sound and sustainable fiscal outlook. So he could do something that's good politics and good policy at the same time, but he's just not doing it. And I think that's because for the Democrats, tax increases are not really primarily a fiscal issue. They're a cultural issue. Tax increases on the wealthy are for Democrats what promises to close the national endowments for the arts are to Republicans. It's something you throw out there every couple of years to get the base riled up and people get rah, rah, rah upset about it. And maybe sometimes you actually try to do it, although the NEA is still out there and the budget continues to grow. But it's not a revenue issue. It's not really an economic issue. I was really disappointed in his speech. And yeah, it's ugly all the way around. You know, I've always known that I disagreed with Barack Obama. I've always known that he had different ideas about politics and about what government's there to do. But I never thought that he was maybe dumb until he gave that speech. And I still don't think he's dumb. But it's a dumb position. It's a dumb one to defend. It's politically dumb. It's economically dumb. It's wrong for the country. And yeah, it was. I'm surprised. I had low expectations for them, and he keeps underperforming my low expectations.
Well, he's accomplished that, I guess. I think the big difference is that Bill Clinton's number one goal was always the advancement of Bill Clinton. And while that's certainly true on some level for Obama, I think the advancement of his leftist ideology even trumps his likelihood of reelection, whereas Clinton would do absolutely anything to get reelected, even if that meant tacking to a course he didn't necessarily instinctively line up with. So.
See, I disagree with that a little bit. Now, Clinton was a good old-fashioned Machiavellian SOB, which is one of the things I liked about Bill Clinton. You know, give me a Machiavellian president on a lot of things, especially, you know, foreign policy. I mean, give me a Machiavellian guy. Obama, I don't think, is any less dedicated to Barack Obama, but he identifies himself and his success with his philosophy. I think the problem with Obama is that he is, yeah, maybe not Machiavellian enough to the extent that he is incapable of entertaining the idea that he may have been wrong about a lot of things. And he thinks that if he just does what he instinctively wants to do, that that is by definition the right thing. And it's by definition the thing that people will come to love and celebrate, because he's so used to being loved and celebrated and to receiving all this adulation just for being Barack Obama, a guy who became president of the United States with basically zero qualifications. I mean, especially compared to Bill Clinton, who had been, you know, governor of a state and done some other things. Obama was just sort of this, you know, hack backbench state legislator guy who gave a speech that was really celebrated and ended up becoming United States president based on that. And he still thinks his job is to give speeches. He hasn't figured it out.
Well, on to his latest speech for Martini number two, and that was this morning at the opening of the United Nations General Assembly. And to his credit, the president has, on some level, learned his lesson from last week's special congressional election in New York's 9th Congressional District, where Israel was a major issue, and the president strongly talking about how our partnership with Israel is unshakable. Israel has a right to security. It's been the victim of terrorist attacks, countless terrorist attacks over the recent years, and that needs to change. And so he therefore essentially opposed the unilateral declaration of a Palestinian state. However, just a few paragraphs later, he offered this gem.
That is the truth. Each side has legitimate aspirations, and that's part of what makes peace so hard. And the deadlock will only be broken when each side learns to stand in the other's shoes.
And after that, the Palestinian delegation shaking its head after the speech. John Bolton came on Fox News and basically was doing his best not to vomit, because he says the president's moral equivalence on this issue is still exactly where it's always been, trying to suggest that the grievances on both sides are equal. Kevin, he seems to be trying, but I just don't think it's in his heart.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to stand in the other side's shoes when they've been bombed out of them, right? And they're laying on the sidewalk. Now, he's partly right about this. I mean, I agree with him. The Palestinians have, in my view, anyway, legitimate aspirations. They have a legitimate desire for nationhood. And I think that is something that has to be accepted and has to be part of the conversation. But the other thing is, they also have some illegitimate aspirations. You know, they have the aspiration to exterminate their next-door neighbor as a precondition for the existence of their state. I mean, they really don't think that they can be a true, long-term, viable national entity unless they liquidate the Israelis. I mean, that's their national belief. It's right there in the Hamas Charter and all the rest of it. You know, we often have this situation where, when we're dealing with foreign hostiles, where we're drawing a difference between the regime and the people. You know, we often said our problem isn't with the Iraqi people, it's with Saddam Hussein. Or, you know, our problem isn't with the German nation, it's with the Nazi leadership back in the 1930s and 40s. The problem in the Palestinian situation is that there's not a real bright line between what the people really want and desire and what the crazies who represent them also want and desire. You know, it's not as though Fatah or Hamas or any of these other sorts of organizations that speak on behalf of the Palestinians are speaking, you know, in some way that is radically different from what the actual Palestinian mood and demand is. And that's where you run into a problem. You know, it would be nice if we could say, well, you know, these crazies don't really speak for the Palestinians, but they do. And we have to take that seriously. And when they're saying, you know, Israel doesn't have a right to exist, we're going to drive the Jews into the sea, and all the rest of the sort of stuff, you know, it pays to take them at their word, I think. You know, that's why I think that we should be paying more attention to the Iranians as well. Although, you know, I'm pretty non-interventionist. I'm not quite a Ron Paul, but I'm maybe a little less aggressive than your average conservative. But when someone says, hey, we're going to get nuclear weapons and then we're going to use them, okay, you know, I want to take it. If I think they're only 10% serious, that's pretty serious.
Right.
And I think the same way about the Palestinians. You know, they say, look, we're not going to rest until there is no more Israel, until we own everything out there. And, okay, maybe they're only 10% serious. I think they're more than 10% serious. I think they're more than 50% serious. But even if we're only 10%, you have to take that seriously. And Barack Obama, for whatever reason, is incapable of incorporating that into his thinking. And, yeah, I think Bolton looked like he was about to throw up in his mouth.
Back to domestic politics for our third martini. And, Kevin, I'm sure you were shocked as I was in recent days when the Ed Rollins experiment did not work for the Michelle Bachmann campaign. But in true Rollins fashion, he leaves by saying, well, we're basically out of money, then goes on Bill O'Reilly and says, oh, no, I'm just an old man. I really can't do this anymore. Apparently he wasn't an old man about 3 or 4 months ago when he took the job. He still now is sending love notes to Michelle Bachmann saying she's the greatest candidate in the race and he hopes she wins, but he's just not on board. Lesson learned, ever since 1984, hiring Ed Rollins is hazardous to your campaign.
Yeah, well, you know, I thought that was an odd marriage to start with. You know, Rollins is such an establishment guy. He is culturally, you know, he's a guy from Massachusetts and got his start in Oakland. And he's not, you know, someone who seems like he would have a lot to say to Michelle Bachmann if they weren't professionally obliged to know each other. You know, if Michelle Bachmann were not in politics and Ed Rollins were not in politics and they were seated next to each other at a dinner party, hard to imagine them having much to say to each other or wanting to. They're not the sort of people who would even want to know each other, I would think. So, yeah, Rollins is kind of bad news, I think, and his explanation of his shenanigans has been less than convincing, but it's probably best for Bachmann to be rid of him. She could certainly do better for herself with someone who actually probably is closer to her in terms of values and style. Although I think Rollins is, in true Washingtonian fashion, being the first big fat rat off of the sinking ship. And I don't think that Bachmann's campaign shows many signs of life and of recovering. You know, I think she's an underrated figure in a lot of ways. And I like Michelle Bachmann in a lot of ways. But with Rick Perry in the race, you know, someone who can straddle both the populist, very conservative Tea Party element that is Michelle Bachmann's bread and butter, but also be an establishment Republican figure, you know, governor of the second largest state and all the rest of it, and, you know, chairman of the Republican Governors Association. You know, he's got enough of a foot in both camps that he's pretty well choked off all of her sources of energy, and I imagine a lot of her sources of money. I don't know this for a fact, but I suspect that when it comes to donors, they're competing for a lot of the same people. There's a lot of overlap between their lists, I would be almost certain. And as long as he's in the race, it's hard to see how she advances.
Clearly, Perry has positioned himself well. That means Karl Rove's going to have to work really, really hard to deny him the nomination. We'll see if he's able to do that, Kevin.
Yeah, well, you know, Karl Rove, the last time he was on the wrong side of Perry, got his butt handed to him. And, you know, it couldn't happen to a nicer guy. I kind of like Karl Rove. You know, I think, again, because I like Machiavellian SOBs, and that's pretty much in the dictionary. It's got his picture next to that. But it's nice to see him get a whipping every now and then. And it's certainly fun to watch Perry do it.
Very interesting all the way around. Kevin, thanks for pinch hitting for Jim today. We'll talk to you later.
My pleasure.
Kevin Williamson of National Review Online. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Thursday for the next Three Martini Lunch.